May it please the Court, I'm Stephen Cass Weiland, and with me this morning is my partner, Robert Hawkins. We represent 22-year-old Khalid Aldosari. He's currently serving a life sentence, Terre Haute, Indiana. We appreciate the opportunity to have oral argument in the case, and we thank you for giving Aldosari the chance to let us argue what we feel is an inappropriate conviction and an unjust sentence. There are three issues that we want to talk about. First, the FISA aspects of the case. Secondly, we want to talk about the jury instructions that Judge Walter gave over the objection of the defendant. And finally, the sentence that Judge Walter imposed on this then 21-year-old Aldosari. Most of the FISA litigation has involved this question about whether the government needs to have as its primary purpose in utilizing its FISA power, if you will, the collection of foreign intelligence information. And that litigation has evolved into, especially after the Congress amended the statute, to whether or not the government had to have a significant purpose. And finally, the FISA Review Court has said, all they need is some measurable purpose. We're not here to talk about that. We recognize those cases have been decided against the defendants. We also recognize that the government basically has carte blanche now to go and use FISA to prosecute domestic crimes. And that's what they're doing. That's what they did in this case. As long as they adhere to the minimum requirements of FISA, and what is the minimum requirement that we are so concerned with? The probable cause to believe that the target of their warrants is an agent of a foreign power.
That's your narrow focus.
That's our focus. And to the extent that our opening brief rambled around about the FISA history and what's happened in this case and what didn't happen in this case, we apologize. But that is our focus.
Okay. Now the rambling, you know, you're nice to put it that way, but partly you have to ramble because you don't have much access to much information to see whether there was primary, sole, significant, or probable cause. That's part of your concern, but I don't say that necessarily favorably to you because below you also challenged the nondisclosure order. But I read your brief very carefully, and you aren't challenging that now to us.
That's correct, but we're challenging the finding.
You are challenging the finding, but therefore you're accepting the Holy Land framework. You're accepting that we would review de novo, but in camera and ex parte, correct?
We are.
So the 1806 ruling is not before us.
Correct. But we are blessed with the fact that Congress has said that you have a de novo look at this.
Yes.
And we're your opening comment about the handicap that I'm operating under is obviously much appreciated, and it's an issue that affects defense lawyers across the country all the time.
But I played a lot of baseball, and everyone has to pick and choose their battles, and the 1806 issue seems to me a much more difficult one than asking us to do our de novo review of in-camera materials. The district court made a ruling, didn't cite Fifth Circuit law that I see, as to when isn't the standard, what is the standard? You get disclosure if it affects due process? Is that what it is? What's the 1806 rule? To the extent that due process requires discovery, you're supposed to get it.
Correct. That's essentially what the statute says.
Right.
And, of course, we have a judge. The district court judge who ruled on this was the subject of a motion to disqualify. She vehemently opposed, but lo and behold, the government did not oppose the motion. So he had to step down. But Judge Walter never reviewed this stuff. Judge Walter never made a ruling on whether they had probable cause. So we have a situation.
He denied the motion to suppress, did he not?
Judge Cummings did. Okay. So what we have is a situation where in the arrest warrant and in the indictment and in the presentation of evidence and the closing arguments and the sentencing, Aldossari is portrayed as a lone wolf, or at least not someone who's acting on behalf of a foreign power.
But you're clear in your brief that at the criminal trial stage, there's no obligation in the government to address that issue.
There is not.
So you're inferring from the way they proved the elements of the crime that that must have been what they asserted, correct?
It has to be what they asserted. That's apparently, they not only asserted it to the FISC, but also to the Attorney General, because Judge Cummings, in his order, talked about, well, they've also complied with the emergency provisions of FISA. So apparently they went to the Attorney General first, and then they went and got some warrants from FISA. Of course, we don't know. You know, I'm swinging.
How do you know Judge Walter didn't review the application for the FISA warrant in ex parte? How do you know that?
I don't know. I mean, he didn't say he did, and okay. he adopted the previous rulings of the district court and went on. By the way, Judge Walter did a terrific job with this case, and nothing I should say here this morning should try to be interpreted otherwise. He gave the defendant a very fair trial.
Well, he's a careful judge. I'd be surprised if he didn't review that material, and I just wondered how you knew that.
Well, we didn't have a ruling from him on it, so it's possible he looked at it, Judge. So, in essence, we're urging you to take a very, very hard look at this. I mean, I'm up here swinging it in curveballs that are invisible, because we don't know what they said.
You're guessing that they said a lone wolf theory, and your entire argument's predicated on
that. We don't think they said lone wolf theory. We do not think they said lone wolf. Shortly after, there is a lone wolf provision in the statute, as you've alluded to. Shortly after this case got rolling, the Assistant Attorney General for National Security testified in Congress that they had never used the lone wolf provision. In fact, he testified to that effect in Congress on the day that Aldossari was indicted. So they had to be using agent of a foreign power. And there's nothing in the record that we ever saw, including the discovery, the trial evidence, et cetera, that would ever show that they really had probable cause to go there. So let me talk for a couple of minutes about the jury instructions. Of course, the defendant is charged with attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction, not attempted construction of a weapon of mass destruction, attempted use. So, unfortunately, I mean, for all of us here, the government started to investigate this case, and 2 weeks later it arrested the guy. We don't know what he really ever would have done, but they've charged him one count, attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction. There never was a weapon. So we go to the trial. Very fair trial. Judge Walter announces that he's going to give this instruction. We say, you can't give that instruction. It's not the law in the circuit. It's certainly not Fifth Circuit pattern jury instruction. So we don't have to give deference for that. He says, some preparation, when taken together with intent, may amount to an attempt. We recognize that this was a hard-fought case and that these attempt instructions have troubled trial judges and this court for a lot of years, because when do mere preparations become an actual attempt? You've looked at a lot of drug cases, things like that. We've cited three cases, the Oviedo case, the Hernandez-Galvin case, and even the Sanchez case, which the government relies on to such a great extent. Those cases all talk about acts. Acts, acts, acts. Even Sanchez. What the judge in this case did was, he said, if you find that he's done some things, some preparation, and then you look inside his mind and decide he really intended to do something here, then you can convict him. That's not the law. And that hurt us badly.
When you read the whole sentence, though, doesn't he say that mere preparation is not an attempt? And then he goes on to say that some preparation, I would assume he's trying to distinguish between mere preparation alone and some considerable preparation, may amount to an attempt.
Well, he didn't say that, but maybe that's what he had in mind.
Isn't that the sense of what he's trying to say?
Perhaps. Perhaps that's what he was trying to say. Unfortunately, he said it in a way that that we won't know if the jury convicted Aldossari because of what he was thinking.
But, I mean, you have to read the whole sentence. You can't just take one clause out of the sentence, is my point.
Well, I certainly agree with that, Judge Davis. You have to read it as a whole.
The whole attempt instruction is multiple paragraphs. And you are complaining about that one sentence,
yes,
year
we are.
Plus. Yeah.
Yes,
so you're saying if there's a lot of evidence of his sound and fury, jihadist or whatever, that conceivably the jury compensated for less actions by heightened proof of scienter? That's your argument? And then, whereas Oviedo and our case law said you can't cross-compensate at all?
That's what I would say. And this is what the government...
In closing argument, do you have anything you can point to that the government actually exploited a sort of...
Absolutely. We absolutely do, Judge. I'm sorry I don't have the site right here, but it is in our brief, where we commented that on at least two occasions, and maybe three, in the assistant U.S. attorney's closing argument, he reiterated this sentence, intent, some preparations coupled with intent convict him. That's an attempt. That's an attempt to make to use a weapon of mass destruction. In their brief, they say it's highly unlikely that the preparation sentence misled the jury into thinking it could convict on mental state evidence. Highly unlikely. Well, maybe it did. That's in their brief at page 61. Now, the sentence in the case. We're looking at this really 21-year-old kid who's going to be 40, 50, 60, 70 years in jail. And the essence of our sentence argument is this. The judge enhanced his guideline score by 11 points by erroneously deciding that when he saw the government shrink, he was trying to feign mental illness, and therefore he obstructed justice. 2 points. If you decide that that was erroneous, unfortunately, that doesn't get us low enough on the guideline score to do us any good. But the judge also adopted this cross-reference from the probation department, which said he was attempting first-degree murder. And we think that was erroneous on the part of the judge, and he should not have adopted that additional nine points. The defendant never had a weapon. He never had a target.
Well, they did find evidence of some targets. Probable targets that he had selected, didn't
he? There were ramblings in his journal about New York, about the Cotton Bowl, about President Bush's house. He had so many targets. He had as many targets selected as references in his journals about American women that he wanted to marry someday. I mean, this guy was all over the map, but there was never a target like there was in the case out of Austin where the individual was going to blow up the IRS building. So,
what's your best case under that guideline provision? There has to be a single identified target. Do you have one, or is it just
we don't have a case that says you got to really focus on a target? But that was a critical element in the Polk case, the Austin case.
But where, Polk's not really favorable to you, is it?
Well. The government certainly doesn't think it is, and Polk hadn't made a weapon, but Polk had a lot of meetings. Polk was set on bombing the IRS building, and I think it is distinguishable. Finally, we would say that the judge erred in terms of the sentence from a because it was substantively unreasonable for him to give Mr. Aldossari a life. We really like the analysis of Judge Southwick in a case called Sandlin, which we did not cite in the brief. That's at 589 Fed 3rd, 757. The judge in this case gave some, I don't want to say lip service, but some attention to the Section 3553 factors. We would say that was vastly insufficient, and that if he had looked at it more carefully, given the age, the no prior record, the mental distress the kid was going through, he would have given him some lower sentence.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wiley. Mr. Cagsmark.
May it please the Court. Matthew Kesmerick on behalf of the United States. The District Court did not reversibly err in determining that Aldossari, number one, met FISA's definition of an agent of a foreign power, number two, took several and myriad substantial steps towards using a weapon of mass destruction, number three, deserved the life sentence that is recommended by Congress, the Sentencing Commission, and the advisory guideline range in this case. I wanted to speak to the FISA issues first. FISA does not give carte blanche. FISA is not a minimum requirement, as anybody in the intelligence community will tell you. If you go through the statute and you look at the myriad checks and balances at the Article 2 and the Article 3 level, you'll see that the procedural hurdles that law enforcement and counterterrorism professionals must go through are onerous, far more onerous than Title III applications, for instance. And those Article II and Article III actors in this case reached the same conclusion after reviewing the FISA materials submitted, that there was probable cause to believe that Aldossari was an agent of foreign power engaged in international terrorism as those terms are defined. I would echo counsel's sentiment that you should take every opportunity to review the FISA dockets. I think you will see Article II and Article III actors all singing in the same chorus. You have the Attorney General, the Assistant Attorney General for National Security, the Deputy Unit Chief of the National Security Division's Office of Intelligence. You have four U.S. District Court judges that are assigned to the FISA Court by the Chief Justice.
What's your, I mean, these are profound questions, and when you say Article II and Article III align, that's still the government. So it's the government telling the defendant, trust us, we've really looked at this. You heard my questions opposing counsel. If this isn't a minimum requirement, how many times under 1806 has the government disclosed the materials to defendants in any case that you know of?
Your Honor, in three or four decades of FISA litigation, that has never happened because it's never been required.
Okay. Now, if you say it's never been required, but it is required under the statute if it would implicate due process, right?
No, sir. That's not the standard applicable in this case where we have a motion to disclose or suppress. If you refer the relevant provision that was before this district court judge is 1806.
Right. And if I read 1806, it says, except to the extent that due process requires discovery or disclosure. That's the statute.
And then it goes on to specify where that disclosure is set forth as the FISA procedures allow. The court may, it's a permissive rule,
it's
the court may.
It's permissible if it's needed to ascertain the legal accuracy.
Exactly right. And the necessity
right.
goes.
And then 1608G, the next section says, except when due process requires. Is your position, the government's position, that you wouldn't have to disclose if due process required? In other words, the affidavit contained exculpatory information. Guy didn't do the crime. You wouldn't have to disclose it in that situation?
Your Honor, all of these cases, to my reading of the case law, have fallen under the motion to disclose procedures. There are no due process cases briefed
Well, yes. I mean, the issue was litigated. The district court on page 12 and 13 said we're denying his motion to get the discovery.
Yes.
The reason it's significant is he spent 30 pages of his brief litigating, guessing to us that the theory here for probable cause is a lone wolf theory. That's everything he's argued because he didn't see anything below.
Right.
Perhaps he's wrong. That might not have been the government's theory. All I'm asking you is if in the papers, which we have to review de novo,
yes,
we see something that's exculpatory, I'm assuming it's the government's position, you would have to have turned it over. Yes or no?
Were the issue litigated under that procedure and the district court judge found one of these due process bases, then yes. But what is litigated?
Well, one of these would mean Brady and Giglio material. All that 1806 does is mean Rule 16 doesn't apply. Discovery isn't reciprocal. But tell me if I'm wrong. Would the government ever take the position that if there were something that were impeaching of a government trial witness or exculpatory, you would be obliged to turn it over if you choose to use foreign intelligence information to prosecute someone criminally?
Your Honor, as this case was litigated under 1806F and 1825G, and all the cases cited in both parties' briefing, the court, under a permissive rule, may disclose materials only where the disclosure is necessary to the district court's determination. And there has been litigation of when that necessity might arise.
We have de novo review of that, don't we?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. And I encourage you to dive into the FISA dockets as much as defense counsel. But if you were to review the first document available in those FISA materials, it's the government's classified memorandum in opposition to defendant's motion to suppress FISA-related materials. You will see citation of case law and collection of case law where we make clear that no court has ever found it necessary to disclose FISA materials. And the necessity stand, some courts have spoke to hypothetical cases that you're speaking of where the need might arise. And they have said, and this is cited at R3, page 33, disclosure in the unclassified memo. Disclosure is necessary only where the court's initial review indicates that the question of legality may be complicated by factual misrepresentations, insufficient identification of target, or failure to comply with the minimization requirements. This judge had the benefit of full briefing on that subject matter. It had all of those FISA Court of Review cases before it. It knew that necessity standard, and that was the basis for the 1805 findings. All he was required to do in this case is to respond to a motion to disclose and suppress and enter the necessary findings under 1805.
In this case, don't misunderstand me. I think opposing counsel has conceded he's not attacking the non-disclosure order at all.
Right.
He's accepting the entire framework, and he's encouraging us, like you are, to do a de novo review.
Yes, Your Honor.
It just seems to me, before you get to any of that, my own thought is there's judges can look at material, but judges should not do it in camera and shouldn't do it ex parte, although it happens in the criminal context like Roe v. Arrow.
Right.
It's just that's still the government looking. And
and
protective orders could occur. And it just startles me that in the entire history of this act, disclosure has never been deemed necessary.
In Your Honor, to the lay practitioner's mind, that is offensive. Because as attorneys who are well-versed in due process and notice requirements, the architecture is initially and facially offensive. But this is the architecture that Congress gave us under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and it was a measured public policy decision to protect foreign intelligence information in such a matter. The check here is not the astringent light of adversarial litigation. The protection are all these procedures. The Attorney General certification, all the declarations. If you look at the signature pages in those FISA dockets, you will see names at the highest level of the Article II branch of government. Those are the checks. That's FISA's design, and it was followed to the letter in this case. This case seems exceptional to me because I'm typically arguing sentencing appeals. It's not exceptional to to members of the foreign intelligence community. This is a very routine application of FISA. And every box was checked. Every box was checked at the highest level. And that Okay. It's unfortunate that the civilian mind, but
thoroughly, I've gone astray because neither side is arguing this point.
Could I call your attention to individual page numbers that will speak to this agent of foreign power
in the
FISA dockets? I think the first document the court will want to look to, of course, is the classified memorandum in opposition. You have the benefit in the record on appeal, the publicly available record of the unclassified version. The classified memorandum does a much better job of addressing some of your concerns, matching the facts of this case to the legal standards. Yeah. So I think some of your public policy concerns will be allayed maybe if you have the benefit of
it's
that.
It's not a public policy concern. It's a constitutional concern, right?
I consider that.
In 1972, the Supreme Court had this difficulty, too.
Yeah, in the Keith case, absolutely.
So it's not a public policy concern. It's that it's startling to think that in no case ever under FISA has there been any Brady Giglio material contained that had to be disclosed constitutionally?
Your Honor, if I may, and I know there's lots of footnoting in FISA briefing about the batting average at the FISA court and the FISA Court of Review. That, as is often the case with statistics, that is a that's sort of an overrepresentation because the denominator doesn't include all of the declinations, all of the times that an FBI supervisor gets a declination from the Office of Inspector
right.
General. There are lots and lots of declinations that don't go into that denominator, and just as an overview, the vast, vast majority of FISA applications never culminate in an Article III criminal trial. So those statistics
right.
are a little bit overstated and over-inclusive. I wanted to point to tab 7 in the FISA docket. That's the verified application and the orders that follow. If you would pay attention specifically to pages 4 through 31, you would have a statement of the facts. And specifically on pages 5 through 14, you would see discussion of this agent of foreign power issue. There's also, in that tab 7, a memorandum for the record where the FISA court speaks to what it specifically relied on. And that's paragraphs 1A through D, pages 19 through 23. So in that tab, there is specific attention paid by that FISA court to this issue and what it relied on in reaching that decision. And you can perform your de novo review. Tab 8 is another FISA docket, another verified application on very similar issues, this issue of agent of foreign power, pages 5 through 15 and pages 25 through 26. And then in tab 9, you'll find the final FISA docket with the verified application declarations and affidavits in support, as well as the orders at pages 4 through 14, 20 through 29, and 34 through 35, you'll see a robust discussion of this agent of foreign power question. You'll also see a notice of arrest and detention where there's additional disclosure to the FISA court about the pendency of the case. I wanted to clarify that Judge Walter did order that all previous rulings remain in effect. You can find that at R3, page 370. He performed his own review of that, so there's an additional measure with the recusal issue. Probably my final point on the FISA applications, there's a lot of discussion of a pretextual use of FISA to prosecute an inherently domestic criminal activity. I think that is highly unlikely for all the bureaucratic reasons and just the procedural weight of FISA. But I'd also point out that the courts have held that evidence collected through FISA is not categorically restricted to foreign intelligence, although most of it leads strictly to intelligence and work.
Is it essentially a plain view type situation? That you're in there because of some significant or valid foreign intelligence purpose, and then if you see evidence of a crime, it's usable. That seems to be the nexus that the statute asks for.
Yes, Your Honor. It's similar to that. It's not directly analogous. The court in Abu Jihad, which is 630 F3rd at 128, it speaks to a bona fide foreign intelligence purpose. As long as the reviewing court, and by here I don't mean the FISA court judges, but the district court in a criminal proceeding, as long as they find a bona fide foreign intelligence purpose and it's not the ultimate use to reach this domestic activity, at least the court in Abu Jihad said that's the standard. I'd also point out that there are minimization requirements. Your honors are very familiar with Title III minimization. You'll find in the FISA dockets the minimization policies and their application in this case. And further to this point about using FISA in a criminal prosecution, I'd point out the Ning West case. That's 477 F3rd at 898. Domestic criminal evidence collected during FISA search may be used even if it's outside the scope of the original application. So it's unusual statistically that it led to this FISA's use led to this investigation, but it's not legally problematic. I'd like to spend time on the attempt question and the jury charge. I just reiterate that the tilt of the field favors the district court judge here, and it also favors the findings of the jurors in this case. It's an abuse of discretion standard. Substantial latitude is given to the judges in crafting this. And you know, further to Judge Davis's point, we look to the totality of the charge. This judge didn't have the benefit of myriad attempt WMD statutes or patterns. There actually is no circuit in the land that has a pattern for an attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction. All have been forced, therefore, to resort to general attempt instructions. In this case, the court initially charged the parties with drafting their proposed jury instructions with reference to the pattern. The court started with that. The government started with that. It was actually the defendant, and this doesn't rise to invited error or waiver, but it may be an equitable point. It was the defendant that began requesting additional language from Fifth Circuit case law. He just finds himself now on appeal, upset that there was too much case law, specifically the Manduhanu case law that he dislikes so much that uses some preparation language.
Remind me, is the jury charge conference where this back and forth in the record?
Yes, it's in the record. And what's also in the record, further to this, the point that the judge didn't abuse its discretion, this issue was thoroughly litigated and briefed in pre, mid, and post-trial briefing on substantial step. He heard argument at the charge conference. You can find the briefing at R4 193 through 201 and 245 through 53. So, and the judge was highly complimentary of counsel on both sides. So he had, in exercising his discretion, about every available resource possible. In addition to that, the judge also had the ABDO instruction. This court just published an opinion in the ABDO terrorism prosecution. So the judge had the pattern, had extensive briefing, was lifting language from Fifth Circuit case law published, and it had available to it the ABDO instruction, a case that was tried just
ahead. The particular sentence that they say is offending, that that arguably would allow a jury to cross-compensate.
Right.
Mere prep becomes sufficient for attempt if bad enough intent.
Right.
Was that or wasn't that focused on and argued by the government in closing argument? Ladies and gentlemen, you may not have heard much about actions, but if you find that he was sufficiently incensed, that could be enough to equal an attempt. Was there any type of argument of that nature?
Your Honor, the government did argue the charge and quoted directly from the charge every time that it did. I don't recall the totality of the sentences cited, but you have a recitation of the charge over and over again. And that's because this substantial step issue was litigated start to finish.
Yeah.
And it was litigated in opening by both parties. It was litigated in closing by both parties. There's not much more a district court could do in fashioning this charge. And I would note that this court does not think mere preparation and some preparation are synonyms. In fact, if you refer back to Justice Holmes' treatise on inchoate offenses that is cited in the Copeland opinion, you'll see a double citation to this language. As the court is explaining that some preparations may amount to attempt if coupled with intent, it is using the some preparations language to distinguish such a case from remote or mere preparation. So I know it has become the toxic tort of the case, this one sentence. But this court has never viewed it with such toxicity. It has used the language repeatedly in the Manduhanu opinion, and there's lots of briefing at the trial level and at the Court of Appeal level now. Courts have really struggled to demarcate this line. The court here gave a full, at the request of defense counsel, gave the fullest recitation of Fifth Circuit case law that was then available. And if all else fails, I would note that this is subject to harmless error review. And there's no question that there are substantial steps taken here, particularly when contrasted against Polk and Abdo. You can read our brief. You can look at our charts. You can look at, you know, his fusing of wires, a disassembly of clocks. It's simply untenable that he did not cross that substantial step line at some point. And as to sentencing, I would note that they did opposing counsel did not object to the cross-reference for attempted murder, so that will be reviewed on plain error. That's an intent standard, and intent was not contested in this case. You can take defense counsel at his word that he is never going to challenge intent and didn't do so. I see my time has expired.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir. Okay, Mr. Weiland, back to you.
Thank you, Judge.
Rebuttal.